Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, but I'm party.
And Jake Latondras.
And bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I am Rocky LaFleur here in the Duck South Studios on this Thursday. Cold Thursday morning. On the other end of the line with me, Double R2, Mr. Ramsey Russell.
Morning, Rocky. How are you, sir?
How cold is it in Jackson? Brandon.
I poked my head out the door this morning. They say it's in the high 20s, low 30s. I hadn't poked my head out the door yet. But it looks cold out there this morning.
Well, it is fast approaching. I know you got a lot of preparations you got to get done, and especially with Duncan being home, I imagine he will jump in the truck and go and do as much as possible before he has to go back, report back.
Yeah, he has been too. It's been a whirlwind visit. It's hard to believe the week passed so quickly, because he been making contact with a lot of friends. We've been eating good dinners together. He's been helping me catch up and everything. We're gonna hunt together some this weekend, and then he's back off Monday 4 p.m. He's headed back to North Carolina for part one of his training. We'll miss him.
What was the one meal that he requested?
Steak. Just big old thick beef steak. We cook filet. We don't eat filet a lot. It's kind of expensive cut of meat, but you know, we like to cook it in a, I'll sear it on two sides on a cast iron skillet, about three minutes, put it in the oven hot for, just pick up the whole skillet and throw it in the oven for about 4 minutes, and it'll come out rare. And He just asked for steak. We threw the filet. We did the filet part. I tell you what, that meal right there is rare we eat it. But when we cook it, it doesn't matter where the kids are. They come home to eat. They sure do.
I was going to say,
I need to pick up.
One of the forgotten ways to cook a steak, and I love it. My brother, oh my Lord, throwing it in a cast iron skillet and then cooking a little bit and then throwing it in the oven. He uses a little bit of garlic, a little bit of and butter in his pan. What's the greenery he puts in there with it?
Rosemary.
Yeah. Oh my Lord. I guess it's three.
I don't put the butter in it. I don't put the butter in it until it comes out of the oven, because if I try to put too much butter to start, I cook it real high. It'll just smoke everything. It smokes everything up as it is.
That's what he does.
Yeah. I cooked that recipe for some friends one time over in Atlanta. And, man, I'd been invited to go on just a heck of a turkey hunt. Forrest and I had. I thought I was going to cook these steaks, you know, just throw them a good thank you. And, golly, you'd have thought their house was on fire. I didn't know her air vent didn't work. I started using her kitchen, and Lord have mercy, it the whole house looked. They had all the windows open. It looked like smoke, like the house was on fire. Smoke coming out of that kitchen. I had so much smoke going cooking this steak, but they were perfectly cooked. They were good. That's how a lot of your restaurants will cook those fillets, and I just think it's the best way to cook it. I just hate to put a Rubik's cube size fillet on a piece of coal. Say again
for people that are listening to this. Tell them how time and ingredients you use to cook a steak in a cast iron real quick?
I get a thick steak. I get about a 2-inch thick cut of tenderloin. I rub it down in olive oil and shake it down with coarse salt, pepper, and garlic. And if I've got rosemary, I'll put rosemary on it. Then let it sit for an hour on the counter, just kind of get real nice and room temperature. And then when the potato's done or whatever mama's cooking is ready to go, because this thing goes together real quick, turn the oven on up to about 450. And every oven's a little bit different. You got to play with it some. I'll get that cast iron skillet real hot. And I throw my steaks in, 3 minutes. At 3-minute alarm, boom, I flip them over, 3 minutes. Then I pick that whole skillet up, throw it in the oven for 3 to 4 minutes. Then I pull it out, pull it off the skillet quick as I can, put it on a tray, and let it rest for 5 minutes. And my wife and daughter, like a lot of women, they don't like rare. And I like rare. On a lot of cuts of meat, I like rare. Not medium rare. I do like medium, but I like rare. And you can just about cut those steaks with a fork. With a good cut of beef, you can just about cut it with a fork. You can certainly cut it with a dull table knife. And it's just the best way to eat a nice cut of meat like that to me. I don't like cooking my ribeyes that way. You know, but I like to grill them. But I sure do like to cook filet in a skillet. And when I'm done and when it's resting, or I may throw half a stick of butter and get it going good. If you throw it in too soon, it's gonna smoke, boy. It's gonna smoke and start to burn. That's just a mess. But I just, you know, we cook it on special occasions. We're not your traditional turkey and ham Thanksgiving and Christmas people. It's just the whole family can do without smoked turkey. And we eat it some. I like it when it's injected and done right. That's just not our favorite course meal. And I was still working for the federal government. We used to have them, you know, holiday potlucks, and everybody show up with something, you know. And it was just the same old something, something. And one day I suggested steaks. And man, I tell you, one of the best cuts of beef I know is a little chevron over on Highway 61 in Vicksburg. It's like right there at the gate going to the Delta from Vicksburg. They've got some really nice cuts of meat. And I went over there and got us some ribeyes. And we cooked them. And Anita caught wind of it. I think maybe she even came and ate lunch with us that day. And that's what we started doing at the house. On holidays, is, you know, we don't eat just tons of steak around the house. But when we do, we like to get a nice cut. And that's what we started doing for Christmas. That year, we cooked the filet. And that became everybody's favorite meal. And I'm going to tell you, I can send a text. You know, far from being in town, yeah, he's going to go spend the night over here, go do that. I said, we're eating filet tonight, boom. His boots are on my dinner table. They're not going to miss a cut of meat like that. That's what we do around here.
So what all have you got to get done before? Because I know you've got a lot with the big camp like Willow Break.
We're about wrapped up on all that good stuff, Rocky. I just got to get over there, and that's going to take wandering around the house and the garage and getting odds and ends together. And I started this week as I thought about things I needed to bring and needed to get together, making a list so I didn't forget anything or I didn't forget as much. And I keep a lot of stuff over there at camp this time of year. You know, I do. If I showed up with nothing, I could survive. So we're in good shape, and we, you know, a camp like Willow Break. Everybody talks about America being a democracy. America is not a democracy. America is a constitutional republic, and we hire politicians that we think will represent our interest to go up there and duke it out in Washington D.C. Let me tell you about a democracy. A democracy. It's three guys in a pickup truck. One guy wants to go to McDonald's and two want to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken. Guess where you're going to eat? that's a democracy. And duck camps and deer camps are a democracy. I feel like I've got the biggest civic lesson you can possibly get by being in this camp for 17, 18 years. And what I've learned is, like a lot of life things we talk about, a lot of topics we talk about here and elsewhere, it's not important that all the members in camp think 100% alike. I envision it like we're at a shooting range. Man, it's not important that we're all aimed at the same bullseye. As long as we're more or less all shooting down range, we're in good shape.
I got an off-the-wall question for you.
Go ahead.
Totally off the wall. You've hunted all over the world. You've hunted with tons of different film crews. Who's the most famous person you ever hunted with?
Say that again, Rocky.
I said, you've hunted all over the world. You've hunted with a ton of different film crews and different people. Who's the most famous person you ever hunted with?
You break up a little bit, man, or my headphones are dying. You still there, Rocky?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I think I heard the question, but I can tell you. I gotta tell you something. Getting change the subject a little bit. I gotta tell you something. This podcast stuff, I guess people besides my mother are really listening. You know, I hear a lot from a lot of people. Some of these episodes we've done recently, I heard a lot from people. But it just blows my mind. Yesterday afternoon, a package arrived to my house from Alabama. And I opened it up. And inside, these two beautiful green wingtail, hand-carved cork green wingtail decoys. And I love homemade decoy. I just love them. It blows my mind how bird looks like a bird looks, but how you see a bird, how I see a bird, what jumps out at you and what jumps out at me in a mallard, in a green wing, the highlights are different. We remember them different, and then we express them differently based on our memory and our creativity and our artistic ability. But these are absolutely beautiful decoys. And a young man named Joshua Clark from Hartsell, Alabama, one of your listeners, went into the Line podcast, and he wrote one of the nicest letters I've ever gotten. And he just wanted to send these decoys. He heard a podcast we did a couple of times ago about my history doing cork decoys, and he's heard a lot of what I've talked about raising my boys, doing this thing with me since they were 3 and 5 years old. The thing I love about Facebook is when those things in your past pop up. The one this morning was 9 years ago. It was Forrest and Duncan at camp holding a couple of young bucks, a little couple of spikes. You know, we shoot management bucks over there. When they were 10 and 12 years old, they were raised into it since they were potty trained. And it's so humbling to have received something like this. And I'm very appreciative. And they did not go on the mantle. I put them right out there with my gunning rig. Decoys like that deserve to be hunted. They're absolutely beautiful. And I know they're going to decoy some green winged teal. And I think that's a pretty nice way to bring in, because you asked me who's the most famous person I've ever hunted with. And I've been blessed to hunt with a lot of folks. And people, Rocky, is really one of my, it's really one of the favorite things I like about what I do. I like people. Especially fun people and interesting people. I don't like rude people or mean people, but I like most people. And most people are very, very good people. Most people you meet in life are real, real regular people. No matter where in the world they are, they're just regular people. But I'll tell you this story. It goes back to carving those decoys. Because a couple of episodes, talking about Spoonzilla, and I told you how I carved it one time. And the year I got married to Anita, I did a little bit of hunting in the Delta. I did a lot of hunting in other part, East Mississippi. Not a ton of ducks, but we'd go out and shoot some ducks. Close to school. On weekends, we'd drive over to the Delta. Rocky, I mean, this was a long time ago. You know, like my major professor I worked for at Mississippi State University, we had a lot of graduate students. I worked for him as a research assistant, and part of my job was overseeing the graduate research program. And a lot of our grad students were funded from Corps of Engineers, and we were doing projects on Mahana. We were doing wildlife surveys and set up shops on Mahana and Twin Oaks and other Delta places like that. And so we were kind of on the cusp of it. My knowledge, we were the first person, I don't even know if they'll let you do it anymore, to back a boat down off in that main ditch across Hog Bow at Mahana, and there was a big old bean field at the time. Everybody kind of lying around the water's edge with cane blinds and two or three dozen decoys, because you had to walk it in. That's all you could carry walking through that gumbo that far. And I asked the manager, could I back a boat off in there? He said, well, yeah, as long as you don't tear up my structure. Four of us grad students, we begged, borrowed, and stole every decoy we could get our hands on, to include some pop bottles, black pop bottles, to make numbers. We backed it off, and we went about a mile down that ditch, out into the middle of that body of water, surrounded by just dozens of groups hunting a little cane blind with two or three dozen decoys. And we had about an inch of freeboard running down that ditch. We were loaded down. Big raft of birds out in the middle of it. And we got out and threw decoys. I mean, we threw decoys, Rocket. We threw 200 or 300 decoys out. We could hear people heckling us for throwing all those decoys out. And we climbed up in the natural cover. We hit the boat, climbed up in the natural cover. And somebody sailed a duck out towards that raft of birds. Their dog went out there to get it and busted out that flock of birds. They got up and left. When they started coming back in to raft up, where they'd been sitting quietly, out of gunshot range and disturbance from everybody sitting on the water's edge, who do you think they came over? That was something. That was something else happens. You know, but you know, the thing about it is, and doing that in front of God and everybody, we kind of taught the monkeys how to dance. So those days, we had it to ourselves that time, maybe the next time. But after that, everybody did it. That's fine. But that day, that afternoon, it was duck hunting like it's supposed to be. It like, even though there was a lot of folks out there, we had it to ourselves, so to speak. And it was right about that time, you know, I did a lot of hunting out Columbus Lake and things like that because it was convenient. I really had to work until I got off for Christmas break, and on weekends had a real job. And at times I'd go 7, 8, 9, 10 weeks without taking a weekend off, because when we collected a lot of data around the Southeast, a lot of gross data, and I needed my students, and they had to go to school during the week. So on the weekends I'd travel down to Mobile Tensaw Delta, over to a lot of Anderson Tully land, a lot of their research projects, and that's what we did. We collected growth data from middle of August all the way up to first or second frost. That's when we had to get all that growth data for regeneration. And then during the duck season, I had a couple of girls, undergraduates, that were real good at inputting data. And until they got all the data inputted, I was free to go duck hunt, deer hunt, do what I needed to do besides sit at the office, kind of catch up on all that time I'd worked. And so that's what we did. Well, anyway, I get married that year. I got married right before I took that job. Got my undergrad degree and got married. Was going there to grad school. And my wife, who grew up south of Washington, D.C., her dad was federal career there in Washington, D.C. for his whole life, or his whole career practically. And she mentioned going up to see her parents on Christmas. I'm like, that'd be fine, you know? Well, I didn't know she meant like over a week. I really didn't know when we were talking about this, she was talking about more than just a day or two, understanding it was duck season. And, you know, back in the good old days, Christmas was a good cold snap. We didn't have to wait till the very end of January to get a ton of ducks. That's when we got real cold weather, and that's when ducks showed up, and that's when I was off. That's what I do. That was, I mean, for newlywed, that was kind of our first little knockdown drag out, so to speak. I've been married nearly 25 years, so guess who won that argument? So off we go. 18-hour drive we drive. I'm pouting the whole way. And I get up there, and my dad-in-law, who was not a hunter, and my mother-in-law, who's not a hunter, they'd asked around, found some stuff, and they found a duck hunt. They talked to somebody. Somebody said, well, you know, over there, there's some decent duck hunting. And he ought to, you know, it's cheap. I think it's $150, $200 a day, little day hunt. Go hunt with these folks. I believe the name of that place, it was in Chestertown, Maryland. And I got up. I bet I got up at 2:30 there on the south end of Washington, D.C., and drove through the Beltway and drove across Chesapeake Bay and drove into Maryland on the east shore and hung left and went north up towards Chestertown. I was supposed to go meet my guide, and I don't remember the exact time, but it was well before daylight, and it was just where you meet them, like at a quick stop. I remember getting pulled over by Maryland State Trooper that morning because, man, I was shagging. There wasn't a soul on the road. I was slick back when I got pulled over. And, you know, just being from Mississippi, you know, I never forget this officer coming up with he had a straight back like them boys on Paris Island. I mean, had his campaign cover cocked just right, and he come knocking on the glass, had his mag light and license and registration, please. So I gave him a driver's license. He says, I need to see your registration. I said, can you describe it? He says, sir, you don't have a registration. I go, I'm from Mississippi. I'm pretty sure they don't ask for that kind of stuff. I can look around, but I don't know what I'm looking for. I think the man cracked a smile. Any Mississippi, huh? I said, yes, sir. He goes, what are you doing up here? I said, I'm trying to go duck hunting. I'm running a little bit late. He gave me my license back. Let me go. And I told my guide that morning sitting at the quick stop when I met him. And he said, you're the only person I've known in 30 years not get a speeding ticket on that highway doing that kind of mileage. I said, well, I am from Mississippi. We kidded later. The guy probably didn't understand my accent. He probably didn't know what the heck I was saying. But the crazy thing about meeting this guide, Mike McBride was his name. He was tall. He wasn't quite as big, tall as Justin Martin. Let me tell you guys something. You see him on TV, he looks like a big old boy. When you meet Justin Martin in person, it's like that guy on the Green Mile that everybody just looks straight up in the air at. He's a big guy. This guy wasn't that big, but he was tall. I'd say 6 foot, six foot four. And remember, I'm a duck hunter from Mississippi. I meet this guy, and he's got a long mullet down past his shoulder blades, permed up, blonde beard, and in the early morning.
Got to respect the man that's got duck guy that's got a mullet.
Now he got long hair, and it's all wavy. To me, it looked like a perm. Maybe it was natural curl, but I'll never forget. You know, I couldn't help but notice he had a diamond earring. You know, diamond stud his earring. And just first impressions, super super guy, heck of a duck caller. But first impressions was, boy, you ain't Mississippi no more. This is my duck guide this morning, and I don't think we have duck guides like that in Mississippi and Arkansas. You know? So, well, Mike, what do you do when you're not duck guiding? I'm a musician, he says. I play gigs, man. And he starts playing air guitar like bass guitar. Boom, 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 boom. So I just mentally file up. Well, he probably played at the local Ramada on Friday night. You know?
I'm sorry.
That's just my impression. So we get in the truck. We get in the truck. He says we're a little bit early for where we're going hunting today. Let's go to camp and we'll get sorted. We'll have about 15, 20 minutes. So we go to the little staging area there on the farm we're going to hunt. It was a little mobile home, very clean, very well kept, very well located. And, you know, Rocky, the thing about it is when you think of – when you're in Washington, D.C. in that area, if you've never been, you are in an ocean of humanity. And once you get over to the eastern shore, even though there are quite a few folks as compared to Mississippi with a state population of 3.5 million people, or probably less than that, you know, when you get over that part of the world, it's surprisingly, the eastern shore of Maryland is surprisingly a lot of agriculture.
Rural. Yep.
It really is. Nice houses, nice landscape, but it's agriculture. You got to be careful of deer running out in front of the road. At least you did then. We get this little old trailer, and I'm just, you know, getting my boots on and looking around. And he got this stack, neatly stacked, and there in his den of his guide house, stack of wooden and cork decoys. Beautiful. I'd never seen anything like it. I'd never put my hand on a working decoy like that. I'm from Mississippi. We use just cheap old plastic and pop bottles if we needed them. And I'm marveling at them. And he starts telling me about, you know, because everybody, remember, that's where the Ward brothers are from. They're so, that's where all of those old Havre de Grace carvers, they're all right there on the eastern shore. It's a huge, huge culture in that part of the world around Chesapeake Bay, where all the market gunners came from. And he described that way back in the good old days when he was a little boy, he and his dad had bought them from just a local no-name carver for $5 a piece. And like a lot of those guys, when they came out with those newfangled gee whiz plastic decoys, you know, a lot of them old boys just went and burnt them old heavy water log things they had. And the only ones you see now that are being auctioned for a fortune are just ones that, you know, nobody ever got around to getting rid of. They got stuck in a barn or in the attic or out behind something else in a garage, and, you know, or somebody just kept them for sentimental reasons. I remember him telling me he wished he had them all. But he had a reasonable pile of them. And so we go out to hunt on this narrow little creek, Swan Creek. And it was bone-chilling cold. It would be, you know, that kind of front that hits, kind of like this one that hit. Remember how windy and blustery it was yesterday? The day after, that kind of real deep Arctic blast comes through, and it's bone-chilling cold, but it's still, the wind hadn't laid down yet. It's just blustery and just, you know, you don't want to hit your hands with a blunt object. They're so cold, that kind of day. And we go out, and it's windy, and we go out to this little creek, and the whole creek, as far as you can see, is lined with phragmites. It's kind of like a cattail, but it's longer and taller and more slender and more brittle. And we set out a few decoys, plastic decoys, not those nice family heirlooms, which we hunted over the next day under the threat of being killed and buried on the farm if we shot a low bird over them. And we did not. And we're sitting out there and we're shooting birds, and it's just a magic day. I can tell you it was a better morning than it would have been wherever I would have been hunting back home. I just know for a fact it was me and Mike and another guest or one of his buddies. And I can assure you it was a whole lot better mounted action than anywhere else I would have been hunting that morning. I was confident of that. And we were shooting mallards. Do not shoot hens, he says. There are too many mallards. We'll get our mallards. We'll wait it out. Just pick our shots. But the craziest thing about those mallards were they would, it's like, you know how you got to read those birds, and some birds want it loud, some birds want it quiet, some birds want to do this, want to do that. It was weird because it was big flocks of mallards, Rocky. It was fairly big flocks of mallards. And it's like, if you got quiet, part of the flock would drag the other flock away. So you got loud. Well, now the other part would come in, but the other part would fade. It was maddening. they would hang just out of range, and you just call and call and call and call. It's like, my gosh, what do I do to, you know? So it wasn't just chip shot shooting. You had to call them. And he kept, you know, he had a real fast cadence. He kept telling me, these birds don't like that southern drawl. They don't like that southern drawl. They can hear, they want to hear my call. What I found out, because I shot 3 bands that morning. When his dog came in with the first band, I'm like, holy cow. Well, it said Remington Farms on it. I'm like, what the heck is Remington Farms? He goes, that's a DuPont duck, man. What's a DuPont duck? Well, DuPont's a big old agrochemical corporation somewhere up there, and they outgrow bazillions of mallards. It's like they just, maybe they still do it, maybe they did it, but at one time, then, apparently to propagate the wild bird population, Dow Chemical, who's not a duck hunting company, would raise a bunch of mallards on their property. As the birds grew up, they would just kind of venture off. And what it was is they had mixed in with the wild mallards. And the DuPont ducks liked the loud and a fast and aggressive. But the wild ducks with whom they were mixed did not. They were mixed, and they were pulling each other. See what I'm saying?
Yep.
So it was a little frustrating. And it was nonetheless a very, very awesome hunt. He had a one-eyed yellow lab named Jake that had put his eye out on a piece of phragmite when he was a puppy. Kind of walked around like Popeye, or ran around like Popeye. Awesome dog. Man, he would get up in those frags, and it's real dense like cattails. We'd drop one across the creek. Man, he would hit that water, swim across that creek, swim all up in that mess, and come back out with that matter. Never missed a beat. Never missed a beat. And we had a lot of fun that morning. Well, some of the young guys listening may not remember this. Some of the old guys may not remember it. But Bill Clinton was in office back in those days. And put all the politics, anything you think about Democrat, Republican, and all this crap going on, just put all that aside. You know, back then, conservatives didn't like him. But the country was being run by a very conservative House and Senate. So we had...
That's right.
He had no choice but to be a moderate. And really and truly, it was good to be a young American getting out of college and building a family and building a home in that period of time, regardless of who's president. And like I said many, many times, you know, put all the politics and put all the Hillary and put all that, forget that part of the story. At the end of the day, duck hunters are duck hunters. And around that time, around that same period of time, that year before I showed up to hunt here, Bill Clinton, former governor of Arkansas, who you got to figure is probably a duck hunter. It hadn't crossed my mind that he was a duck hunter until it was all over CNN and major news outlets. Bill Clinton went duck hunting. He went duck hunting somewhere up there on the Eastern Shore. And, oh my gosh, you know, it was all over TV. It was like live for hours. And the most endearing image I have of that spectacle was him literally sitting on the side of, you know, the back bed of a truck, just sitting in the back of a truck, sitting up on the side like anybody would, and him holding a single hen mallard. That was it. The president went hunting, shot a single brown duck. And somewhere during the lull in the volley, we got to talking about that. I said, Mike, you know, Bill Clinton hunted up here somewhere, president of the United States. He goes, and Bill, Mike talked like a rock and roll. Yeah, man, he talked like a musician, man. Man, Bill Clinton stood right where you're standing, right here. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, man. He stood right here, he hunted right here, and I was his guy. I said, Mike, that's incredible. You guided President Bill Clinton, the most powerful man in the universe? He goes, you dang right. I said, I'm sitting here looking at this pile of greenheads. I go, you let him shoot a hen? He goes, huh, he's president, Ramsey. I said, well, I'm sitting here looking at all these ducks we got. All these birds have been flying. Especially since there wasn't no southern accent calling. In the blind, I can't believe you took the most powerful man in the universe duck hunting. He don't come out with a single hen mount. He said, son, let me tell you something. He said, back here's my trailer. Out there on the road. He said, everybody, every news agency in the world was right there, piled around. He said, man, trucks and vans and RVs, and they had them big satellites, and there were people milling around and writing on notepads, and they were just everywhere. They were milling around everywhere. He said, and up and down, for miles up and down these woods, were men talking in their sleeves and trench coats. He said, F-14 Tomcats, wow, flying air. That man was guarded like nobody else. And I hope the black helicopter don't kick my door in 5 minutes, Rocky, and take me out for saying it. But according to the story, he said, that man shot everybody ducks. He shot everybody ducks. He just wanted to come out with that brown duck, show the world. So they didn't get mad at him, you know, for being a duck hunter. That moment in time, I realized, you know what? I want to hunt with the President of the United States next time he goes hunting. And I was young and impressionable, and all I could think is, boy, I wish I hunted with Bill Clinton. And so, so anyway, I didn't hunt with Bill Clinton. But years later, I know the story's dragging on, but you got to think Paul Harvey, rest of the story. We're talking about the most famous celebrity I've ever hunted with. So years later, I'm hunting up there with Chris Wujek and Mitch Toba. Chris had talked me into coming up to do a snow goose hunt. I didn't want to do. I was hunting with Lane Gill at the time. We were doing a lot of spring snow goose shooting, creeping and jump shooting birds. And let me tell you what, Patrick Pitt, Steve Pitt, Pat Pitt, they wrote the book back in those days on how to save the tundra. And I was right there with them. I mean, they wrote the book on how to save the tundra, and we were having a good time. And, you know, by the time you got done running those ditches and doing everything involved with it, I didn't care if I ever saw another snow goose for a while. You know,
killed every white devil alive.
We took it to fleet level. We posted some pictures on the internet one time that just broke open World War IV on the internet. Just some pictures that just disturbed people. Especially the guides, you know, that were trying to decoy. The clients would show up with pictures like, we don't see too many birds. And the guy was like, but anyway, Chris Wookie called me up and invited me to come up there snow goose hunting, spring snow goose hunting. And I'm like, man, you know, I don't care if I ever see another goose right now. That's a long way to go. I don't think people will be interested, blah, blah, blah. And he said, Mr. Russell, I guarantee it'll be the best spring snow goose hunt you've ever been on. I said, well, I take that pretty serious because down here in the South, guarantee goes a long way. He said, I understand. He said, if you'll come up here and hunt with me, if the 2 or 3 days you hunt with me to check me out, if they're not the best decoy snow goose action you've ever had, I'll reimburse you for your plane ticket and we can part ways. I said, I'm coming. I flew up there. You're going to fly with like 3 boxes of 3-inch steel ammo on a plane. That's 11 pounds. And I went through my stores, my little cache, and I pulled out 3 boxes of steel fours for snow goose hunting. I said, we'll see how good that hunt is. We'll see how good that guarantee is. That's all I needed. It was the best snow goose hunt I'd ever been on. The main migration had passed through weeks ago. Had a few old birds holding out. Nobody was hunting them. Nobody was disturbing them. There may not be but 250, 300 of them, but they've been sitting there for 2 or 3 weeks. We eased in the morning and just lit them up. It was spectacular. It was awesome. And kind of word got out because of the way we were publicizing ourselves pre-Facebook on the internet, on chat rooms. And I got contacted. Get Duck was young, and we had to take advantage of opportunities back then. And I got contacted by somebody that was related to an outdoor television show sponsored by Beretta. I believe. And so we scheduled to go up there and film the show with them the following year or two, whatever it was. And I get up there with some clients, and the hunting's tough. It's a hard north wind blowing. It's the first week of May. A hard north wind blowing, and the whole migration has stopped. It's waiting on the wind to lay down. They're all down around Devil's Lake, which not too terribly far. It's just a few hours flight to the Snow Goose Flaps to get on up that part of the world, but they had just sat. The migration ceased in the face of that north wind. The clients and I shot a few birds. It wasn't a bad hunt, but it just wasn't the hunt, you know, I had experienced. And the company had sent a whole bunch of full-body decoys that they had to hunt over. And I don't know how John Mann found us. I don't know how he drove up on us that day, but where we had been hunting, there seemed to be some goose activity. Before we loaded back up the trailer, just Chris and I, we decided, let's pull out these darn full-body decoys and assemble them. Well, there we are, twisting heads on and punching feet to bodies and getting everything sorted and getting everything bagged. When up comes a rental, SUV rental, and out steps John Mann. John Mann goose calls. And I don't know if you ever met him, but Sean is just such a nice guy. He's such a good guy. And I know, no pressure or nothing, he says, but y'all got any geese around here? I've been driving around all day and I ain't seen nothing. Chris and I have been kind of worried because we got a TV show coming that there ain't enough geese to make a TV show. Thank God they're going to be there 4 days. He said, don't worry, we'll kill some, don't worry. And it was slow the first 2 days. I can tell you that right now. And we ended up going back out that same field, and it was myself and Sean Mann and Chris and a couple other people related to the show or Beretta or something, you know. And it was just that kind of hunting where you're laying out in the field as long as you can stand it. It's raining, and the wind's out of the north. It's not raining like you know, frog choker, but it's raining enough you got to kind of squint because it's wanting to fall in your eyes. All day long, we may have shot a half dozen birds. It was terrible. Sure didn't make much of a TV show in the first couple of days like that. But that day laying out in the blind, just you had a lot of time to talk with the people you were hunting with. And I learned how Sean Mann got into making those geese call of his. He's a musician. And as I remember, and I may be wrong because it's a long time ago, as I remember, he played the clarinet in high school. You know, and a lot of the same air qualities and tongue in the notes and doing things. And his interest having grown up in the Eastern Shore, out there around the Chesapeake Bay, and geese is a big, big thing out there, the Canada geese. And that just kind of parlayed itself into a goose calling business, a very, you know, world championships and everything else. And somewhere along in that conversation, I heard him say he had a drum collection. You know, goose caller, musical instrument, drums. I'm like, oh, you got drums? He says, yeah, I play drums, man. I play gigs, man. And all them years later, just the way he said with that Eastern Shore brogue, something to the effect, I play gigs, man, you know, drums. He's talking, you know, drums, kind of played a little air drum, you know. It just, boom, you know, it just like deja vu. And so I just said, you know, this is a reach. I hadn't seen this guy before since. This is a reach. But have you, you know, a guy named Mike McBride? He goes, yeah, he's our bass guitarist. He comes over every weekend. Man, we play music. He's our bass guitarist. I go, wow, that's incredible. You know, I hunted with him, start telling the story and everything else. And getting up to the most famous celebrity I've ever hung with. And I got kind of quiet, and he says, when you hunted up there with him, what dog did he have? I said, he had a one-eyed yellow lab. And he kind of chuckled and go, yep, old Jake. I said, yeah, how's him, Jake? He said, well, that's a great dog, wasn't it? I go, sure, boy. He says, well, let me tell you kind of the rest of the story, because I know Mike didn't tell you this. because he didn't brag, didn't want to say nothing. It's just life as a musician. He said, but Mike's also a songwriter. Did you know? He said, no, I just played, I just knew he played bass guitar sometimes, And he said, yeah, he wrote songs like a lot of musicians. And he sold a song. He said, there's two ways you sell a song. You sell a song for a little bit and keep royalties, or you sell a song for more. And you take the money up front. And he said, when you sell it like that, a lot of, starving artist type might have to do that sometimes. You know, whoever you sell it to kind of owns everything. So their name and credit may just disappear. Oh, he says, but he wrote a song about that dog you hunted over. I said, really? He says, yeah. He said, and it went all the way up to the top of the billboards. I said, what is it? He says, he wrote a song called Feed Jake.
Feed Jake.
So Feed Jake, he's been a good dog, my best friend right to the end.
Oh, wow.
Pirate of Mississippi bought it and sold it all over the radio. So when people ask me, sometimes they do, just like you did, hey, you hunt with a lot of people, who's the most famous person you've ever hunted with? The answer is it wasn't a person. It was one of the most kick butt labs, one eyed, I ever hunted with, on one of the coolest hunts I've ever been on in a part of the world that was unexpected, seeped in history. Dog that fetched duck for President Bill Clinton and everybody on his security detail, and it lives forever in the annals of country music history. I thought that day, I always think of that when I think about fame. The coolest thing is, that dog didn't know anything about fame. He was just a duck dog. He just did his job. He fetched ducks. He did what he wanted to do. But isn't that cool? I actually hunted with Jake of the song Feed Jake.
That is a really good story. It was Paul Harvey-esque. That was a great way of explaining it.
Yeah. Oh, Paul Harvey. Nobody tells a story like he did. Nobody can tell the rest of the story like he did. But tell me you wouldn't go hunt with President Bill Clinton tomorrow if he asked you to.
Oh, heck yeah.
Oh, Lord. I just let, it's like I always said, man, in a duck blind, politics and religion and money don't matter. Everybody's just a duck hunter for the time. Even the president. And you got to figure the former governor of Arkansas shot ducks. It never crossed my mind, but you had to figure he did.
That's a great, great story, Ramsey. I never imagined from the beginning of you telling that it was going to turn out to be the dog.
No. No, what a great dog, too. One-eyed yellow lab named Jake.
Wow. Well, good luck to you this weekend. Hope y'all have a great time. Cherish every moment with Duncan being there. I know you will.
Absolutely.
Savor every moment.
We're going to hunt with Commander's Corner this weekend over in Arkansas for the Arkansas Open. It'll be our fourth or fifth year over there with him. And he always does a real good job. He's always got ducks. And it's a great atmosphere just to socialize and hang out with your family. So we're really looking forward to it. Likewise, good luck to everybody else listening. That's going to go hunting. And if you're going to be hunting Mississippi instead of Arkansas, you still got a week to get your stuff sorted for duck season coming up.
Ramsey, I enjoyed it today. Be careful going over there. We will talk to you soon. Thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.